Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, here with co-host Katie Wang. And joining us for the first half of the show is Eric Balkin. He's the executive director of the Glen Canyon Institute. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with the basics. Tell us about your organization. Who are you and when were you founded?
Glen Canyon Institute was founded in 1996. We're a nonprofit organization with a mission to restore a healthy, free-flowing Colorado River through Glen Canyon and Grand Canyon.
So give us a brief summary of the geography of that Glen Canyon and Grand Canyon and the area that we're looking at.
So Glen Canyon and Grand Canyon are sort of the heart of the Colorado Plateau and the Colorado River Basin, which includes seven western states, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and California, and Mexico. Lake Powell and Glen Canyon Dam are the primary storage reservoir for the upper Colorado River Basin. Lake Mead, below the Grand Canyon, is the lower basin's primary reservoir. So Glen Canyon Dam is the dividing line between the upper basin and the lower basin.
So how long have you been with the organization?
I've actually been with the organization for about 11 years. I started working for them in college as sort of an office lackey.
You graduated.
Exactly. And I stuck with the organization. I just am very passionate about this issue. And about 4 years ago, I took it over as the director. Here we are.
Fantastic. So the motivation for founding this organization, it had to do with the dam, right? So what was the motivating factor to get it started?
Well, our founder and president is Richard Ingebretson, who's a doctor and a professor in Salt Lake City. When Rich was a kid, he went on a scout trip through Glen Canyon, and his scoutmaster, as they were hiking up a canyon, he told the whole troop that, you know, you should really take this place in because in a few years it's going to be underwater. And I think at the time, you know, as a kid, he didn't fully understand the gravity of what that meant. And then later in his teen years, he went on a trip with some friends to Lake Powell, and they went to that same canyon, and he looked down from the motorboat and looked down into the place where he walked as a young scout. And I think that at that point, he realized that what was lost at Glen Canyon was, you know, totally unacceptable. It was one of the most incredible places on the planet, and that it should be restored. We should get Glen Canyon back.
I'm really interested in the history of the Glen Canyon Dam. I mean, it's been called David Brower's biggest regret, right? And you always think of him as this, you know, iconic conservationist, head of the Sierra Club. I mean, he's done great work throughout his lifetime. But Glen Canyon, sadly, was not saved, and it was somewhat thought of as the sacrificial lamb. So if you could kind of tell us a little bit about that story and then really what happened as a result of that, this colossal mistake.
Yeah, so Glen Canyon Dam is considered by many to be our country's greatest environmental mistake, and it took place in the midst of a fight of a number of dams in the upper Colorado River Basin. The Bureau of Reclamation had proposed a dam in Dinosaur National Monument, which drew a lot of ire from the Sierra Club and the public at large. And the Sierra Club led a successful campaign to stop a dam in Dinosaur National Monument, which is a very pivotal moment for environmentalism in the United States. It was the first time an environmental group actually stopped a dam. In doing so, Brower said that if they didn't build a dam in Dinosaur, then they wouldn't fight a dam downstream in this place called Glen Canyon that David Brower didn't know about. It's often referred to as a place that no one knew, but a lot of people actually did know Glen Canyon. It's really more.
We know this. What are you talking about?
It's really more the place that David Brower didn't know.
Right. Sadly.
And as a result, the Sierra Club didn't really put up a fight for Glen Canyon until it was too late. And after this had happened and a bunch of people reached out to Brower, he made several trips down there and he realized that Glen Canyon was, in fact, far more. I don't want to say more beautiful than Dinosaur, but its grandeur was a lot bigger. It was a lot longer. It was, you know, a lot of the early river runners considered it to be more beautiful than the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
So there was a big promise for this dam to help with, you know, help irrigate the arid lands of the Southwest. You know, did that come about? What did this dam promise? Why were people motivated to put it in place?
The primary purpose of Glen Canyon Dam is water storage. And if you ask a water manager if it has served that purpose, you know, they could make a really good argument that it has, because the Colorado River is naturally fluctuating. It has really big years, really low years. And having a dam block this water back essentially allows the upper basin states to hold on to excess water in wet years and deliver our legal amount downstream in dry years. And so to that regard, Glen Canyon Dam has been fairly successful at hanging on to that extra water. But you have to ask yourself, was it worth what was lost? I mean, we're talking about 186 miles of some of the most unique river ecosystem in the world. And as I said, the people who ran river trips down there thought it was, you know, on par or even more beautiful than the Grand Canyon.
So is it possible to restore? I mean, is it too late, right? It's like, you know, you flood this beautiful area and you think, okay, it's now been, you know, however many years since 1963. Is it gone? I mean, it's, you know, has it eroded away and is there really anything left to save at this point?
I think there is. A lot has changed in the 54 years since Glen Canyon Dam has been built. The idea, you know, when Glen Canyon Institute was founded 20 years ago or 21 years ago, that you could get Glen Canyon back seemed ludicrous at the time, because in the 90s, Lake Powell was basically 100% full. In 1999, Lake Powell was almost completely full. After 5 years of low snowpack, the reservoir came down to 33%. And for the first time, you know, the public and policymakers and water managers looked at that and they were like, wow, you know, this is not a permanent reservoir. And the realities of climate change and water use on the river system mean that, you know, Glen Canyon and Lake Powell is likely never going to be full again. Lake Powell and Lake Mead, their combined storage is some of the lowest it's been since Glen Canyon Dam was built in the 1960s. So, you know, Lake Powell's about half full. Lake Mead is about 40% full. Climate models are predicting that it's only going to get warmer. There's going to be lower runoff in the system, and that the likelihood that these reservoirs will fill again is really low.
So there are also serious issues with loss of water through evaporation and then sort of like leakage into the groundwater, correct?
Yes, that's right. So, you know, dams are not 100% efficient at storing water. Every dam has loss to, you know, definitely evaporation and in some cases seepage. And this is very much true at Glen Canyon, where the Navajo sandstone is very porous and a lot of water seeps into this, into the walls and is essentially lost to the system, as well as a number of, you know, a huge amount of water that's lost to evaporation. And some of the data that has come out has shown that it's probably more efficient to store that water in one reservoir, Lake Mead, instead of these two half-full reservoirs. If you can't fill up both reservoirs, why are we still inundating one of the most incredible canyons in the world when we could move that water downstream? We could completely drain Lake Powell into Lake Mead right now, and Lake Mead would still not be full.
So you'd still have that idea. I mean, the conceit that you're trying to hold back water, use it in low water years, could be still achieved through Lake Mead. It sounds like what you're saying, but you would be able to restore essentially Glen Canyon at the same time. You can basically, you know, have your cake and eat it too, right? You can have the water storage, right? But then you can also have this beautiful canyon. I mean, it sounds like that's what you're
Yeah,
aiming
for. In simple terms, yes. There's a little political hurdle that you'd have to reach to get there first.
But ideally, that's your goal,
yes,
right, to get
yes.
there. And have you seen, as the water levels have dropped, are you seeing natural habitats coming back? You know, obviously you're getting exposure to some of these beautiful arches that were covered up. But
Absolutely. As I mentioned, Lake Powell is just over half full right now, and it's been hovering around that level for about the last 10 or 15 years. And as a result of that, we've seen a number of side canyons come back to life and a bunch of the tributary rivers. If you've ever done a river trip down Cataract Canyon, when Lake Powell was full, the reservoir would back up all the way to the end of the Big Drop Rapids, which are very famous, of course. And, you know, you'd do the Big Drop Rapids and then you'd be out on the reservoir and you'd have to, you know, motor out about 20 or 30 miles on a reservoir to get to the takeout. Nowadays, when you run a cataract trip, you have a flowing river almost all the way, in recent years, all the way to the takeout, which is pretty incredible. I mean, that's like 30 miles of a restoring river. And that's just one example of the hundreds of drainages that are flowing into Glen Canyon.
So you mentioned a little bit of a political hurdle. Is it a partisan issue? Is it just because we have put such a massive investment in this and it seems crazy to change? Like, give us an idea of that political hurdle.
Well, the The main challenge to restoring Glen Canyon is a political challenge. As I mentioned, Glen Canyon Dam serves as the dividing line between the Upper Basin and Lower Basin states of the Colorado River. And under the law of the river, the Upper Basin states are required to deliver a certain amount downstream every year. Now, having that dam there allows us to deliver that amount and not one drop more. And so it is very much a political dam. And so in order to fill Lake Mead first and essentially share Lake Mead as a reservoir, would require some serious cooperation from the Upper Basin and Lower Basin states. Traditionally, the Upper Basin does not trust the Lower Basin. You know, folks sure. in Colorado, understandably, you know, the water comes from snowpack. 75% of this river comes from snowpack. And the people in Colorado who, you know, they say the snow falls in Colorado, but and then it flows down, and California has the biggest share of the river. And so there's always been a little bit of a lot of animosity in regards to water.
Why are we watering the desert?
So what else is the lake used for now?
So as I mentioned, the primary purpose is water storage. It also generates hydropower, although it's been producing about half of that in recent years because the reservoir is so low. There's also a recreation economy, of course, reservoir recreation. But if you were to kind of calculate what the importance is of Lake Powell, you know, it's probably 97% water storage. And that's what policymakers are most concerned about. And the
just in order to regulate that flow,
just in
rather
order
than to use it to,
farm. The water in Lake Powell isn't actually used for cities or farms or anything like that. The only people who use water directly out of Lake Powell Reservoir are the small town of Page and the Navajo coal plant. So that water is really sitting there to be delivered to Lake Mead to satisfy a political agreement. And I think that, you know, if we have the chance to see Glen Canyon come back and see one of the most incredible places on the planet restored, I think we should do everything we can to study this idea and work towards that goal if it's just a political hurdle.
And so how is it progressing? Certainly you've been around for 11 years. Are you seeing inroads being made, or is there a change in the political conversation? I mean, we're now certainly, I would think, probably at a low point when you talk about environmental issues and how they're registering at the federal level. But, you know, are you gaining momentum?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is a huge shift in thinking about dams in the United States and beyond. We're seeing dams come down famously on the Glines Canyon Dam and the Elwha Dam on the Elwha River and in the Northwest, and seeing how quickly that habitat has come back. Glen Canyon Dam is obviously a little different scale, and there's some different challenges in seeing the restoration happen. But the shortage that we're seeing, and it's a continued shortage of water on the Colorado River, is creating all these huge challenges for water supply and the environment, but it's also giving us a really big opportunity to rethink how we're managing these big reservoirs. And do we have a chance to actually get Glen Canyon back? Which we do, because we're already seeing it come back in so many places in these side canyons. So it's not because of any environmental groups' work, I'm sorry to report, but really just because of climate change and the continued shortage, which we're calling a shortage. It's not a drought. It's not temporary. It's here to stay. These are the conditions that we're living in. Lake Powell's never going to fill again. The reservoir that we knew in the 80s and 90s, it's not going to come back.
One of the things that's amazing about this to me is, I think you said, you know, this dam went into place like 54 years ago. That wasn't that long ago. Your organization was founded 21 years ago, only whatever, 30 something years after the dam had been built. And that's incredible to me, because I feel like with most of our environmental blunders, it takes a lot longer to understand that we've made a mistake. That just seems like a really quick turnaround.
Yeah. You know, all dams are temporary, and The interest in Glen Canyon is never going to go away. When it was built, it created this huge groundswell of activism against damming rivers, because people at that point realized what was happening and what was lost. The Bureau of Reclamation wanted to build two dams in the Grand Canyon after Glen Canyon Dam was built. And it was because of this groundswell of public opposition and, you know, some good organizing from the Sierra Club and other groups that those dams in the Grand Canyon were stopped. And that, you know, a lot of people would consider this to be the time when modern environmentalism is born in our country. So it's, you know, Glen Canyon Dam has always kind of been this really focal point of environmental activism in the U.S. And for that reason, I think it will always hold interest from the public.
So are you focusing your organization then on that future restoration of the canyon? Are you focused on advocacy? Where's your energy going right now?
Well, we're trying to do it all.
Of course.
We're a science-based advocacy group, so we facilitate scientific research that can actually give some credence to this idea of restoring Glen Canyon. As I mentioned, it's always been a sort of pipe dream of environmentalists and the, you know, kind of epitomized by Ed Abbey and the Monkey Wrench Gang of going and blowing up the dam and getting Glen Canyon back, which is...
Sounds so simple.
Yeah, right. No, but it's, you know, so our mission has always been to actually, like, make a good case for doing this and saying, can we actually do this? And so we facilitated research that backs it up. We've done economic studies, hydrologic studies, legal analysis, and, you know, to make it a real case. And now after, you know, decades of doing this, it's picking up steam. And there was an article in the New York Times in 2016, essentially advocating this idea of unplugging Glen Canyon Dam and letting Glen Canyon come back, which was a really pivotal point for the movement. And, you know, I think it really is picking up a lot of momentum. People are seeing that this river system is changing, that we can't fill these reservoirs anymore. And, we're seeing the change happen right now. And so now we're trying to focus a little more on what's happening in the canyons. How is that restoration taking place? You know, for a time, people assumed that Glen Canyon was a forgotten place and that it would never come back. In the side canyons are really what make Glen Canyon special. It's a really unique landscape in the geology of the Navajo sandstone. There's hundreds of side canyons. Those are small. They get flushed out with sediment really quickly during flash flood cycles. And we're seeing so many of them come back. We're seeing the natural wildlife and plant life come back in a pretty short amount of time. We're trying to find ways that we can measure that and quantify it and make a more scientific case that actually is looking at Glen Canyon and saying, yes, it is, in fact, restoring.
Weren't you mentioning earlier on your website that you can do a virtual tour? Is that to come?
Yeah, so with the help of National Geographic, we built two digital maps, interactive maps, that you can go on our website, glencanyon.org, and take a virtual tour of a historic river trip down Glen Canyon before it was dammed, and also a restoration tour with some really great photography from some of our colleagues that have been traveling down there and some of our members who have submitted photos. Anyone can submit photos to us to be on there and take a virtual tour and see some of these restoring side canyons. I mean, it's really remarkable how quickly they've come back.
That's awesome. So what about downstream from the dam? You know, we've been talking about impacts kind of upstream from the dam, where the lake has impacted all of these canyons. But what about, you know, just miles and miles downstream all the way to, you know, where it meets the sea? What does that look like? What do those impacts look like?
Well, I mean, below Glen Canyon Dam, there's a series of dams. So right below Glen Canyon is the Grand Canyon. So you've got, you know, 224 miles of Colorado River flowing through there. And the Grand Canyon is probably one of the next to the, upstream, of course, in Glen Canyon itself, is one of the most adversely affected places from Glen Canyon Dam. Before the dam was built, you know, the Colorado River was one of the siltiest in the world, and that silt would transport nutrients, it would build up beaches, and it sort of kind of created this riparian habitat in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. After the dam was built, we have cold, clear water in the Grand Canyon, which has devastated the ecosystem, and it's because of that that we have four endangered fish species. And, you know, below Hoover Dam, we have just a number of dams and other diversions down there, and it sort of just becomes like this plumbing system at that point. And outside of a experimental flood that happened in 2014, the Colorado River hasn't reached the ocean in about 20 years.
You say there's some beautiful photography. If you're familiar with Pete McBride, he walked down the Colorado River all the way to the, you know, to the Gulf of Mexico, and it doesn't. I mean, I can't remember how far short it falls, but it was pretty devastating when you see the photographs. It's
yeah,
just how dry and barren it is where it's supposed to be meeting the sea, and it doesn't.
But with that pulse flow that they did, we saw a pretty amazing resurgence of the habitat.
Oh yeah, that's pretty amazing.
And to me, that really gives us a lot of hope to say that if you give nature a chance, even just a little chance, it will come back.
So describe that pulse flow quickly for listeners that might not know about it.
The pulse flow was part of an agreement called Minute 319 in the Law of the River, which Mexico banked some water in Lake Mead to help hedge their drought. And in exchange, the states helped pay for some infrastructure repairs down in Mexico that they had from an earthquake. So it was kind of this exchange where both parties won because the system saved water because of those system improvements. And with some of the excess water as a result of that agreement, they had enough to do this experimental pulse flow, releasing water down into the Gulf of California for the first time, you know, in 17 years when they had done that, which is pretty remarkable. It's an example of interbasin cooperation for, you know, helping the greater ecosystem, which I think is a great example for what we're trying to do, which would be cooperation between the upper basin and lower basin to help restore Glen Canyon and Grand Canyon.
So what's next for you guys? What's the next step?
Well, we're partnering with Utah State University on a sediment study that they're doing, looking at how sediment moves once these canyons are exposed in Glen Canyon. That we're seeing some really exciting results come from that. We're looking to set up a citizen bio blitz where we're going to get some members and members of the public out into the canyons and doing some collection of species and start to kind of build on the scientific data about these restoring canyons, because there really isn't too much information about how they're restoring. And that's where we're putting our focus now.
So if people are interested in getting involved, what should they do? Where should they look?
If people want to get involved with this, which you should because it's a very exciting movement to be a part of, go to our website, www.glencanyon.org. Get on our email list. I think one of the best things people can do to get active in this whole movement is to get educated. You know, we've sent out a monthly email to our members updating them on important news about the river and ways to get involved, action alerts, and those sorts of things. So, yeah, I would encourage anybody who's listening to check out our website, check out some of the imagery, read up, and get involved.
I'm excited to take the virtual tour down the river.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Eric.
Thanks for having me.